welcome to Viva Politics Podcast, a podcast about the intersection of politics, media, and pop culture, hosted by a Generation Xer, that's me, a veteran political consultant, Dr. Laura Vapadena, and the Viva Politics Office millennial, Lauren Coronado. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Laura.
Well, we have a very, very special guest with us today. I'm very excited. His name's Andrew Solano. Welcome, Andrew.
Hey there. Hey, I'm a millennial too, though, so...
I'm outnumbered. But a little bit about Andrew. He's the former chief of policy for City Councilman Manny Pelaez here in San Antonio, Texas. But he's worked at government at all levels, from local to federal to all
state,
kinds of state, everywhere. In fact, I'm kind of figuring out, what have you not done?
County.
There it is. And currently, he's actually working on one of the presidential campaigns. He's helping out Elizabeth Warren. So I appreciate you taking the time to come and chat with us today. And today's topic is going to be protest. So, Lauren, you want to talk a little bit about how this kind of all came to be?
Sure. So there's fun stuff all over our office. And I was looking in the back storage shed, and I found a textbook on the rhetoric of protests, and protests aren't really my specialty. I'm not very loud and more of a strongly worded email kind of person. So I picked up the book and started reading it, and it was really interesting. So I asked Lauda, like, hey, let's talk about protests. So here we are, and I had a few questions.
Okay, well, let's start off with your first question, and let's see what we'll...
So my first question is, why protest?
Why would you protest?
Why protest? That is a good question. You know, I think like this country was built on it, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's something that's as American as, you know, baseball or, you know, the national anthem. I don't know. I guess from my perspective, coming from the inside, I've seen how effective protest can be when you don't agree with something in your government. You know, and I've seen it both ways. You know, I would never... suggest that someone not protest. I think there's better ways to do it than others. But quite frankly, I think a lot of good policy has come from protests in this country, whether it's civil rights or the suffrage movement, you know, throughout our history. And so I think we're seeing a lot of that right now. And so I think people, you know, generationally may forget how recent some of those, you know, issues were, where, you know, women couldn't vote or, you know, minorities in this country were disenfranchised and still to this day are. So, you know, I think it's important at all levels to get, you know, we are a representative democracy. I think a lot of times people confuse those two with like a direct democracy. And, you know, I often joke with people like, look, if you feel like you're not being represented, we could always do direct and, you know, get together Greek style every 6 months and fight it out. And whoever's the last man standing gets the policies. But unless that's a change and we're represented and, you know, your voice matters when you vote. And so.
And oftentimes protests are done to create media attention, right? Because we might have a disagreement with our government, or we might be pushing a public policy. So protest is a way to bring about attention to something. So you create essentially drama that allows the media to come and cover it, right? So that you can reach a larger audience about what you're trying to protest. But part of, I think, what makes protest difficult is that oftentimes there's a notion in the scholarly literature that talks about the protest paradigm. And in the protest paradigm, what they typically do is media tends to disparage the protesters. It often hinders their role and doesn't make them a vital actor, right? So they make them seem as if they're, you know, violent or not, you know, willing to sit down and talk to the table. So they really sort of marginalize protesters. Mm-hmm. And with the advent of the internet and Twitter and mm-hmm. social media and, you know, being able to go Facebook Live, it's allowing sort of this alternative media to give another perspective. And I think that's kind of what protesters have always kind of been in this conundrum, right? It's like, how do we create a protest that brings attention to this this inequality or this problem that I want attention brought to, but without me becoming the news story because I've got to become violent, right? You've got to create some sort of drama for the news to cover. Otherwise, you know, frankly, is peaceful protest interesting to cover, yeah. right? Is that something interesting? Yeah. So, for instance, recently we saw some protests at the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol, around some of the immigration issues that have been going on, and it was a peaceful protest. Mm-hmm. And there was some media coverage around it, but interestingly enough, It was the fact that a local nun was arrested as part of that protest that became sort of the media narrative, right? So protests are critical in helping shape the narrative, the media narrative, so that you can get your point across.
Yeah. Can we go back to attention and media narrative and kind of talk about political theater and the social media's role in political theater and how that plays into protests and protesting?
Yeah, well, I certainly think that social media has allowed for a change in the way that we approach political theater. I think before there was a lot of language, right? A lot of speeches and these kind of, especially when we think about the civil rights movement, we think about marches and speeches, where I think the internet and sort of modern day political theater is much more visual, right? So I can recall some recent protests at the state capitol here in Texas where you had young Hispanic women in these quinceañera dresses, right? So it became a very, I think because of the internet and because of social media and these videos, it's opening social protests that are much more visual than they used to be.
Do you think that that's making them more impactful, or do you think they're just keeping up with the way media is consumed?
I think it makes it more impactful because I think it's a way that you can drive home the narrative and connect with people in ways that sort of language, I think language is a little bit more of a heavy lift, right? Because you've got to get people's attention. They have to listen. Whereas visually, you don't actually have to say anything. Just looking at something gives you the story, right? I mean, imagine if we were to get a whole bunch of grandmothers and they were to take off their chanclas and throw them at the White House. Like, you know, that's sort of that visual. You know, that visual of a protest, you know, could really kind of tell a story without having to even say anything, right?
Yeah, but I think what's interesting to me is, like, how do we gauge their impact, right? Like, is like, how successful are they, and what, you know, how do you gauge their success? Is it because a policy was changed? Is it because they got a meeting? I mean, so often we see sit-ins, right? It's kind of one of the oldest forms of protest, and it's a peaceful protest. But I mean, is getting a meeting with that elected, like, is that a win, right? Or is it actually affecting and impacting a change in whatever level that you're protesting? So I don't know to what extent that happens, you know, with the ones that you've described. You know, again, yeah, they're visual and they're catchy, but at the same time, like, how successful are they? Like, they're going to get a 10-second clip on the news, or you're going to come across your Twitter feed, but at the end of the day, like, I you know, it's not rhetorical. I just don't know, like, their effect and impact.
Right.
Is it the audience reached or the change created?
Right. And I think every social protest has to determine what is a win, right? Because sometimes moving public policy is like, or creating public policy is like moving Jell-O uphill, right? It's these sort of baby steps. And so you sort of look for markers, right? So, like, perhaps maybe the first, you'd have to kind of create a strategic plan and tactics as to, like, what is each protest trying to accomplish? Because sometimes simply getting the attention of elected is enough and is a win. Sometimes it's the actual entire change
and policy. We talked a little bit about it before we got started, but, like, I cited Indivisible, you know, chapters across this country, and, you know, having worked for Congressman Doggett before when his was redistricted into San Antonio as his district director. I know one of his former staffers out of his D.C. office, Ezra Levin, and some folks got together after the Trump election and, you know, put that Indivisible guide together, which was essentially like an insider's look at what works to impact policy, right, through your elected officials, especially at the congressional level, through protests. And most of those are, or I wouldn't speculate, but the ones that you see most effectively used are you know, sit-ins and phone calls. I mean, it's simple stuff, but I think people just kind of didn't realize, like, the impact that those can have. And if you saw, like, what happened in the midterms, a lot of that was, I think, impacted by the guide that was put out there by the Indivisible folks. And, you know, you look at you know, empirically at how many Republicans lost their office or didn't run for re-election based on a lot of what was happening. Daryl Issa, I think, was a great example out in California. It's like one of the richest members of Congress, and just decided to, like, hang it up and was like, nope, not going to deal with this. Because, I mean, like, honestly, I think the goal, coming from an insider as a staffer, like, the fact that if that protest is getting to the point where it's being talked about at a staff meeting, where I'm having to like let the principal or the elected know that, you know, I'm getting tons of emails and phone calls, and our field office is getting bombarded with people coming in talking about an issue. You know, another one that I wasn't in favor of, but like locally, the Chick-fil-A stuff, right? Like when people were just like calling our office and like yelling and sending us Chick-fil-A in the mail. You know, like
Chick-fil-A in the mail.
It was it wasn't a good thing because it was already eaten Chick-fil-A, and it was
just
boxes with crumbs.
Okay, I get it.
That's even worse.
Yeah, but I mean, I would say those are kind of like, you know, effective ways of protesting.
Yeah. Well, and then it's interesting because when there are effective ways of protesting, and the opposition realizes it's effective, they immediately criticize the protest. Because I remember back the original sort of big immigration marches of 2006, like when people marched, for immigration reform, that there were a multitude of flags from all these different countries, right? It was this show of strength. Well, they immediately came back and said, see, they don't love America. They don't have American flags. Mm-hmm. And so that became, you know, a big discussion, right, about how this protest was done. So then subsequent protests, it was like, don't bring any flags except for American flags. Sure. And so they're able to sort of drive that narrative as well in terms of like being able to criticize it for sort of visually what they're doing or not doing. And and you kind of make yourself vulnerable to these kind of critiques based on how your protest is planned. Mm-hmm. And it's not just like what it looks like, but also where it's done, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're protesting, you know, immigration, but you're doing it in a certain neighborhood, like, you know, that all says something and tells the story of protest and how the media is going to cover it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen that lately with the Antifa, like, tag that's being given to folks, I think was it in Seattle or Washington or something, or Portland, I think, where, yeah, like the right is gonna, I mean, they're really good at it. Like the right is like eating our lunch on the progressive left and on the Democratic side when it comes to being able to spin narratives, right? It's like bringing a gun to a knife to a gunfight most often. So I think it's just difficult. And you know, another thing that we probably won't have time to get in today, but it's like this false equivalency argument about like when these protests are happening, right? I mean, because like it's just not equivalent to have someone with loaded AR-15 marching on the Alamo with someone in the Handmaid's Tale, you know, outfit, right, at the Capitol about abortion, right? Like, so, yeah, the right will make, and even the mainstream media will pick that up, and it's like, oh, these protests, right? And they'll run with that. But, like, it's just not the same thing.
Right. And then there's always sort of this tendency that when you're in the protest, you sort of get this crowd mentality, right? So even as well as any protest could be planned, once you sort of get there and you're in the moment and the chanting starts, that
the mob mentality.
And any protest that's been planned, it can go off book, right? Where, say they have a fenced-in area and it's, okay, this is where we're going to do a protest, and all of a sudden the fence gets knocked down and people start marching. And, you know, because you can get caught up in the moment. It can become very emotional. And I think that's also what makes protests so powerful, right? It's not just the visual of it and the media part of it, but this that people kind of get invested and involved in it. And it can get out of control. And it, sometimes it's hard to keep those parameters on it.
Do you think that social media has made it easier for emotions to allow social issues to spiral out of control and kind of create online protests? Like viral posts and things that aren't necessarily factual to just...
Well, I think part of the problem with social media, I think, is that when we go in and we answer Twitter or, you know, post a few things and, you know, argue with someone online, that we feel like we've sort of become an engaged citizen. It's like, there, I've checked the box. I've been politically active today because I posted on Twitter. And the reality is, you know, is that really a form of citizen engagement, right? Do you have to physically march on the street or sign a petition, you know, in person versus a virtual petition online? Like, to what extent is that real protest, or what is it performative protest, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's got back to my original question about like impact and effectiveness, you know, how successful. I mean, I think they're all forms of protest. It's just like a newer version of it. But, you know, again, I don't think it's to the point now, at least in my experience, where, you know, at the different levels I've worked at, obviously now on the working on a presidential campaign, it's different because it's like national and like things that you post, you know, if they go quote unquote viral, how are they going to impact the candidate's platform on something? But using some examples recently, you know, from some of the work that I'm doing on the Warren campaign, are protests. And I can give you two examples. When we were in Miami, protesters showed up about Homestead, and it's something that the senator, you know, had talked about and had been engaged on, but people showed up and used their ability to protest. And, you know, I think two times now successfully that I've seen personally how you interact with protesters are that you you embrace them and you say, great, let's talk. And it also happened with some when we were in Milwaukee recently at a town hall where protesters had shown up for climate change. And so the senator met with them both times. And I just don't think that that's something, I won't speculate, but at least from what I've seen, anecdotally, that's something I haven't seen before, even at like the local level.
Yeah.
You know, if we were going to have a town hall when I worked for Manny or something, it wasn't necessarily something I would see that if we were going to have protesters that, you know, we'd take the council member out or the mayor even and go and talk to them. Yet here we have a presidential candidate at that level saying, look, I'm going to take time out of this town hall that we're already like pressed for time and I'm going to meet with these individuals. And you saw what happened in the Florida case where the senator was the first one to go out to the Homestead migrant camps. And that made news all across the world. And so, again, bring it back home to your point about like whether or not social media, I can't tell you whether or not to prove that if there were protesters online talking about that, but I can tell you when they showed up, it's something that I think was impactful.
Yeah, and I also think that the social media actually, what could be a small protest could actually, you know, help it grow to something larger. Because I think I've sort of seen sort of that flash mob kind of thing where somebody puts something on social and then they realize, hey, this is going on, let's go, right? But you know, there are limitations because just like in any other media, you're talking to certain groups of people. So you have to be able to, you know, reach people beyond what you normally reach so that you can get your protests to grow, right? And also, social media can invite the opposition to come, right? So you may, it can actually create a counter-protest to your protest, which, you know, may or may not work to your benefit depending on what that counter-protest is. But, and we've seen a lot of like protests recently here at a local level where you see people show up. And I always find it interesting, like, there was a recent protest, and it was, like, at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Monday morning. I'm like, who's going to show up at 8 o'clock in the morning? You know,
like, I saw the posting for the protest, and I was like, oh, maybe I'll go. And then I clicked on it, and I was like, oh, it happened this morning when I was still asleep. Never mind.
Yeah, so, like, the timing of protests is kind of important, too, because not only in terms of, you know, you've got to find a balance. Like, you've got to make a protest that's relevant to the issue at hand, right? So in this particular case, there was an issue going in front of a judge, so they needed to protest before it got in front of the judge, so they had to do it that morning
before
before a decision was made. But then there's also considerations of media, right? So like, if you're going to do an 8 o'clock protest, is the media really going to cover it, right? Are you going to be able to get the media out there to cover it and be able for it to be on the 12 o'clock or the 5 o'clock or the 10 o'clock news, right? Yeah. So scheduling a protest, one, when you can actually have people participate in it, and then two, that it's relevant to the cause that you're trying to advance, and then three, that it's actually at a time where the media is able to cover it and, you know, continue the message that you're trying to project.
Yeah.
What do you feel draws the media to a protest? How can you get media present and not just like a random like someone there for a quote, but like a camera crew there to cover your protest? How do you make that happen?
Well, I think there's a couple ways, and I'd really like to hear what Andrew chime in on this, but just from my experience, it's been a charismatic speaker, so someone that's frankly famous. So you have a movie star or a political star or someone, you know, of relevance who comes, and so the media is going to cover that. The other is frankly drama, right? And how do you create drama? Whether it's a conflict, a direct conflict, or I remember a wonderful I call it political theater because it really is, right? You're kind of creating a little drama for the media to cover. It's they were a bunch of protesters in Arizona trying to get Sheriff Arpaio out as sheriff. So essentially what they did was, in the parking lot of his building, they threw him a retirement party. So they literally had tables, a retirement cake, mm-hmm. they had mariachis. And so they sort of created this party where they were saying, hooray, you're retiring. Yeah. And so the media really covered it, right? Because it was very visual, and it was also making a statement. And so the media are attracted to that too. And then unfortunately, violence. I mean, that's the reality mm-hmm. is that when there is violence or confrontation, the media does cover it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. And to that point on the retirement party, I think that when I mentioned Daryl Issa earlier, that's one of the things that I think that those groups were doing for those Republican congressional members. And they ended up leaving office in high numbers. So I think it is effective in terms of getting the coverage. But I think also it just determines, like, what's the issue? I mean, what are you protesting? I remember when I worked for Mayor Taylor as her policy advisor, one of the issues I had in my portfolio was the you know, some of the shooting of unarmed black men, not just in San Antonio, obviously, across the nation that was happening, but we had an incident here in San Antonio, which kind of kicked off something that I had worked on and led, which was the mayor's task force on police community relations. And I remember lots of the stuff that we had planned there. You know, there were protests going on. And, you know, I remember thinking at the time, like, I am someone who's a young minority male on staff, and I'm not just sympathetic, but like I agree with a lot of what you're saying, and yet I think a lot of that was just not understood or not realized. And so I think one thing too for protesters is also, it's not just the principle, it's also when you're protesting issues, there's a lot of staff that are involved in a lot of what's going on in these policies. And, you know, I remember some of those protests, like marching to City Hall. And again, back to the question of like, how effective, how impactful were they? You know, I think at the end of the day, you know, we tried to make some meaningful policy changes based on what we were hearing from those protesters. It's a shame we never got a chance to finish that because she lost her election. But I think a lot of what you see nowadays, though, is kind of born from that. And so yeah, I think it depends on what the issue in terms of how you're going to get coverage. Something like police shootings, yeah, you're always gonna get coverage for something like that.
Mm-hmm. And I think you make an interesting note about protesting, and you know. I know a lot of folks that, you know, it's like, oh, another protest. And it can kind of get frustrating because you feel like all you're doing is protesting and you're not really moving the needle. Mm-hmm. And it can get frustrating. So, you know, and I think that's part of a social movement's responsibility is, you know, how do you keep your quote unquote protesters engaged? How do you make mm-hmm. sure that there's other activities, not just, you know, so you're marching every weekend. After a certain point, you sort of become, you know, I'm exhausted with protesting because it is exhausting. It mm-hmm. takes a lot of time and energy to do that. And so how do you keep, you know, your membership or whoever you're trying to fight for, how do you keep them engaged in the protest movement without protesting every week? And I think that's too, it becomes, you know, creating a larger strategic plan of what you're trying to protest and what your win is, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, you know, we can protest till, you know, we're blue in the face, but if we're not moving the needle on public policy and we're not creating wins, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of that too during my time in the mayor's office or at City Hall in general, like along Vista Ridge. You know, there were some very passionate, you know, protesters and organizations that had like coalitions of people who had come together. And I think it's tough because, again, you're sympathetic and you may agree with a lot of what's being said. But when you're on the inside and you know the realities of what those issues are, it can be difficult because I think a lot of protesters sometimes, and I'm not, you know, disparaging by any means, but, you know, it's a winner take all. There's no gray areas. Right. And so like for Vista Ridge, a lot of the folks that were like friends of mine from like working in other offices before that I was familiar with those types of organizations. It was frustrating because I'm, you know, you're trying to help and you're trying to be helpful. Yet it was like, in that case, well, you know, if we don't do Vista Ridge, then what are we going to do for water? And like, yeah, they would tell you that there were other opportunities out there. You know, well, then just stop using so much water. It's like, well, yeah, but when you have a million people coming, like, that's just not feasible. And I'm sorry, right? Like, that's what the data is telling us. And so, you know, you mentioned about, like, it being exhausted. Like, yeah, it was exhausting for me to watch them. And I wasn't even participating. They were coming, like, weekly or daily in some cases towards the end to protest the vote on Vista Ridge. And so, you know, that's to me is a good example of like, you know, did you change the policy and, you know, how effective was it? Were there other things that could have been done to force some of those changes?
And oftentimes when we think about protests, we think about young people, we think about millennials, we think of protest, like, you know, sort of that's the group of people that can have the time and the energy to actually protest. But I do find it interesting, like, if, you know, if there's a protest and say there's a group of people that don't normally protest, like, that alone could create media coverage, right?
Sure.
The fact that, as I mentioned earlier on, that this nun who was arrested at the Capitol, like, the fact that it was an older nun, that became sort of newsworthy, right?
Oh,
because
yeah.
She didn't fit what we think
Look,
of as
one
a
of the best
protesters,
or I don't know if she'd like to be categorized as that, but someone who I can say without a doubt has, like, impacted change in this community and who you know... I guess I couldn't consider her a friend, but definitely someone who I've worked alongside over the years. But Graciela Sanchez, right? Like, you, if you're in politics in San Antonio, you know who she is. Like, she is an OG protester. Like, oh my God, I remember one of the first issues that I had to deal with working in Congressman Doggett's office as his district director, was getting a phone call saying, like, well, you know that, you know, people are upset about the old Univision studio downtown being demolished, and it should be, like, protected, and it's a national historic, you know, whatever. And, like, Graciela hearing that, like, she jumped a fence in the morning and put up a table and ate tacos, right? Like, that is awesome. And, like, you have to give them respect for that, right? And it's just old school, like, you know, tying yourself to a tree or something, or a bulldozer. And so, like, those are the things that, to me, again, anecdotally speaking, not academically or anything like that, but those are the ones that you see. And, like, yeah, did it still get demolished? Yes. But did she stop it for a while? And, you know, did she try to make an issue? And did I, as a staffer, have to work on that and provide the congressman with some information on that? And in the end, there wasn't anything that we were able to do, but we tried, right? I mean, it was enough to get the congressman to say, hey, yes, we are going to work on this and make sure that there's not something that we can do. Because if there is, then we're going to do it. And you know, that's the type of person that I think Graciela is. And those are, like, the old school that you respect, because they're willing to put, you know, their body on the line, and they're impactful. It's effective.
Right. And then now you sort of have new generation of protesters who do things online, like, you know, if you Google a certain word, a certain politician's photo comes up.
Yeah.
And so it's like sort of technology protest.
Or changing someone's Wikipedia, right?
And
again, like, it's interesting. And, you know, I don't know if there's enough data out there, and I don't know if it's been, you know, perfected yet, but I'm sure technology in one way or the other is going to be as impactful at some point. I specifically haven't seen it. That's not to say that it doesn't work. But yeah, it's just kind of hard to see that being as impactful at this moment than someone, you know, like Graciela, who's going to, like, throw up a, you know, jump a fence and eat some tacos in front of a bulldozer.
What, if any, are the boundaries in protests while still respecting First Amendment rights and inciting
violence?
Well, I would point to Oliver Wendell Holmes, the great justice, and also shout out to my former alma mater going to Holmes High School. But, like, yeah, you, like, First Amendment, right? Like, you can't run into a crowded theater and scream fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a line, right? I mean, I think, you know, we saw recently, I don't know if it started in the UK or what, but, you know, like, throwing pies in people's faces. I think if you're, like, in the law enforcement, you know, you would consider that dangerous, right? Getting close enough to a principal or an elected official, enough to throw something at their face, right? Next time it might not be just a pie. It might be, like, a glass bottle or whatever. So I definitely think, I mean, you know, it's, you know, you take it at your own peril about how you're going to do stuff like that. Like, is it impactful? Perhaps. It got coverage. But I do think at some point, like, you're crossing the line.
Well, and we've seen a lot of that silly string where they go in and they, like, silly string people. And again, it's technically harmless, right? But again, if someone's pointing a spray bottle into someone's mm-hmm. face, you know, who's to say it's not, you know, acid or something? And yeah. so it does. And it's hard because even some of the best organized protests go in with intentions of, you know, nonviolence, but it's hard to control the crowd because it does. You do get caught up in the moment.
Yeah.
But there are necessary boundaries. And a lot of times, you know, groups sort of police themselves, right? And you'll see in a protest where you'll see someone grab someone and sort of pull them out of the crowd because they recognize that they are creating a situation that mm-hmm. makes it dangerous for everyone, not just the people that they're yeah. protesting. Mm-hmm. And obviously, like when tear gas gets thrown and all these things sort of escalate, that it can get dangerous and it does sort of whip into a frenzy where then windows get broken and things of that nature. But not all protests have to do yeah. that, right? There can be very peaceful protests. And it just sort of depends on the nature of the protest itself, the timing, what's being protested. All those factor into it. And then frankly, and it's going to seem weird, but the presence of media, like just having cameras there can actually make people misbehave, mm-hmm. Believe it or not, like because it's like, oh, I have a camera in front of me. I have an opportunity to, you know, create some things that will be covered. And so that I think just the simple notion that that the media is there can also affect an outcome yeah. of a protest.
I mean, there's like probably a whole other show we could do just on that. But like in terms of being counter or being not helpful to a certain protest. I think we saw an example recently where at one of the migrant detention centers, there was a protest going on and someone put a Mexican flag up. And like, yeah, like the symbolism there, I think is definitely interesting. I'm not, you know, saying one way or the other if it was helpful or not, but I know that people on the ground from reports that I saw were not happy that one person or whatever, a group amongst the larger group decided to put up a Mexican flag because, you know, the right spun that into like, oh my God. I mean, it was like the same day that a lot of stuff was going on and like they wouldn't condemn Trump's racist comments on the four congresswomen, but they were very quick. I think at that point, nobody on the right, no Republican congressperson had put out a statement about those Trump comments, but they were all very quick, including my congressman, unfortunately, Chip Roy, who decided very quickly to put up a statement about how, you know, anti-American it was. And they, you know, I was seeing other comments, too, where people were like, they should be shot. And that's, you know, that's treason for putting up. So, like, in the grand scheme of things, like, was it helpful? Probably not. It took away the message about the Trump migrant centers that are going on and children in cages. And now the narrative was, no, there's this Mexican flag that's been hoisted above a U.S. facility, right? And so I think that'd be interesting kind of to look at a case study in of itself.
Yeah, and it is hard to control the narrative too because everybody wants to be able to give their perspective and their story. And it's hard, you know, it's difficult sometimes to get a group to fall into in line really with the larger narrative to see sort of what the goal is. Because you're always going to have people from both extremes thinking that there's a better way to get the message across. And it's like, you know, how do you walk that line? But ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, create that narrative in the media that you want, mm-hmm. because after all, that's why we do protests, right? So that we can bring attention to society and to the elected officials so they could address this issue that we have. So, well, with that, I want to thank you, Andrew, for coming and joining us. And we really appreciate your side. Yeah, cool. And we'll invite you back after you've got a few more months under your belt with yeah. the presidential campaign.
Yeah. And hopefully I won't be too free. Hopefully I'll be busy until November of 2020. So
Exactly. Well, thanks again, everyone, for listening. You've been hearing Viva Politics Podcast with Dr. Laura Barbarena and
Lauren Coronado. And special guest,
Andrew Slaughter.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.